Rejoice, Bachelor Nation. Bachelor Party is the podcast for you. Juliet Littman is here to break down every detail and piece of drama from the latest episode of the Bachelor franchise. Joined by fellow superfans, members of Bachelor Nation, and Ringer colleagues, this is the one-stop shop for all your Bachelor needs. Check out Bachelor Party on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Max. The new HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, is an espionage thriller and cross-culture satire that follows a communist spy during the final days of the Vietnam War and his new life as a refugee in Los Angeles. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr. and based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer is streaming now exclusively on Max. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
Oh, hold up. Smell test. Go ahead. Sniff those pits. Now, your bits. Feet. Toes, come on. Ugh. Could be fresher, right? It's all good. Old Spice Total Body Deodorant Spray is gentle enough to use all over your body, giving you 24/7 lasting freshness with daily use, from pits to toes and down below. So every smell test gets a... Shop for Old Spice Total Body Deodorant.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com. And joining me on the other line, The Watch's foremost Chaucer expert, it's Andy Greenwald!
That's probably true.
Of the two of us? Kaya? I don't know if Kaya, our esteemed producer, Kaya McMullen, I don't know how much Chaucer she crushed in her college days. I personally can't say I've ever cracked Canterbury Tales.
Does watching Netflix's The Chair, which we're going to be talking about today,
which Chaucer figures into, yes.
We've just scared away half the audience. does that make you want to get into it?
I can't say that it does. I always just assumed that Canterbury Tales was like a bunch of people sitting around a campfire farting, but like because of its formal innovation was like, is it?
That's accurate. I mean, there are probably more specific ways to describe it, but that is not the worst way I've ever heard. Yeah.
So I was wondering, I mean, Andy, we have a lot of stuff to get to. I want to talk little bit about a fall TV preview, somewhat of a fall TV preview with you.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to find out how it was, you know, because not a lot of people had the courage to do this, but you saw Free Guy 3 times this weekend. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was pretty cool. And I wanted to know if maybe you'd give us a preview of your sick Free Guy Easter eggs YouTube video explainer that you were gonna do.
Three guy.
That's right. But before we get into the fall TV and before we discuss The Chair, which is on Netflix and the entire season is up now, it's 6 episodes, 30 minutes each, I thought we could just have a little general chit chat about what we've been enjoying recently, how we spent our weekends.
I'd love to. I want to say that one of my favorite occurrences happened this weekend, where my good friend Chris, and people don't realize this about us, this isn't for show. Mm-mm. You know what I mean? Like, our relationship isn't just for the gram. You know what I mean? We are not TikTok influencers. Like, the lines of communication stay open to the point where, and I love this, I treasure this. Like, if it's like a 2:30 p.m. on a Wednesday, I might get a text from my guy being like, how are you? How's your day? Like, it's really nice. That said, the occurrence that happened this weekend is one of my favorites, which is, I'm like, Chris, how are you doing this weekend? And you're like, oh, I did these things and I met this guy and I might have dinner here. And then you ask, what'd you get up to this weekend? And my head falls into my hands. And I'm like, Chris, on Daddington Island, weekends are not full of adventure or possibility. They are wars of attrition, you know, with wonderful moments along the way, like all wars, you know, very memorable moments. The relevant piece of information was not that I saw Free Guy, but that the other 3 members of my family did go to the cinema.
Oh, yeah?
To see Paw Patrol, the movie. I'm still hearing about it. I mean,
yeah.
To hear a 4-year-old describe it, I do you remember like going to science museums and they're like, Mr. Thomas Edison shows a grown man electricity and the old man like weeps, knowing that like, the world is so much more vast than he ever thought. That is my 4-year-old's reaction. Wait,
was there like a short film at a museum you saw that?
Yeah, I just feel like Franklin Institute or like Ben Franklin touches the kite and then everyone's like, everything's different now. Like that's
right.
That's what my 4-year-old feels after watching the Paw Patrol film. just in terms of, you know, the universe expansion.
It's kind of like how you felt after Newsroom.
It's exactly, I mean, this is again, this is why our relationship can't be replicated in an algorithm, right? Like, for people who don't know, Paw Patrol is an absolutely fucking infuriating series about a weird, rich preteen who spends his time and fortune grooming six puppies who also talk and outfitting them with incredibly expensive tech and gear to do things like rescue animals on a farm that are in peril.
From like animal cruelty or from like a tornado?
Like maybe
or?
There's a hole and something fell in the hole. And it's just like, I'm going to need the dog with the construction truck. And it's all just a psyop to
sell
trucks.
You know
what?
This is what's wrong with this participation trophy society where we're just helping animals out whenever there's a hole around. I mean, what are we doing?
I mean, I feel like animals have figured out the hole issue for millennia. You know what I mean? But Chris, there is an element of like, you know, bedrock American bootstrapism because the animals are doing it for themselves.
Gotcha.
Like the Paw Patrol are, they talk and they drive, but they are also animals. But anyway, finally there's a movie that gives us the origin story of Chase the cop dog and they move from their relatively bucolic, if, you know, hijinks filled life in Adventure Bay to Adventure City.
Uh-huh. In the is in the movie or
this is in the movie.
Okay.
And so but, now
which you have not seen. This is just being synopsized for you by your 4-year-old.
I'm just saying, like, the storytelling possibilities in the Paw Patrol universe are huge now that they're in a big city, to hear her tell it. So that was exciting in that I missed it and I didn't have to go. But kudos and salute and solidarity with all parents who did have to go or sit through it on Paramount Plus. I did have a couple other things I wanted to recommend.
Okay.
On this podcast. Do you have any, Chris, do you have any questions about Paw Patrol? Like, do you want to talk about that more?
Nope. I gotta tell you, I don't. It's just like one of those things where it's like there are certain things I feel compelled to be a part of. You know, maybe I gotta figure out what's happening with these Eternals, and these deviants, and these Celestials. I gotta draw a line somewhere, man.
No, I get it, and you know this. Like, I am a big fan of parenthood and of my children. Like, I think it was a good move, but there are things that I miss. And generally, those can be grouped into two categories. One is the ability to do things when I want to do them. And two, sweet, sweet fucking ignorance of Paw Patrol.
Yeah. Like those are the two. Life's full of trade-offs, right? As of now, do not have that feeling where my life has purpose, where this hole inside of me is now filled with love for another human being. But the trade-off is that I don't need to know about Paw Patrol.
This is a real dilemma because I can see the benefits on both sides.
Yeah.
Have you ever considered taking on a ward like Bruce Wayne?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, at times I have. I would want to jumpstart, like, because like I am now like behind my friends. They all have had, you know, like, so like I feel like I would almost want to slingshot past everybody.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying adopt a child. I'm like saying take on a war.
Can I get like a 10-year-old toolsy third baseman?
This is, you know, I feel like we've had this conversation before, maybe on World Hollywood Perspectives Pod. And I do think that your go-to is that you just want an athlete.
I want a prospect. Yeah.
You want a prospect, like a 5-tool child. Yeah.
And maybe he tops out at AA. I'm not looking at it as like a, I don't want financial return off of that. I just think it would be cool.
AA is nothing to sneeze at. Like that's real pitching. You know what I mean? Like that's what really separates. So I hear you on that. If I could indulge you and our audience for just one brief moment and stay on Daddington Island, there is a really, really special show on Netflix that I want to give people a heads up about. And this is one of those rare things that I think is worth it. Even if you do not have children or wards or toolsy hot corner prospects that sleep on
the
your
next
couch,
Brooks Robinson,
and call you pops, there's a show that premiered earlier this year on Netflix called City of Ghosts. It was created by an animator named Elizabeth Ito, and it is really truly incredible. It is, I mean, obviously a little biased because it is about Los Angeles, the city where you and I both live, and it's a show that is really like a really interesting animated combination of like photorealist backgrounds with kind of blocky CGI, but the show itself has an extra layer because the characters are often filming with like analog video cameras. And it's about four kids who are like a ghost squad, and they learn about Los Angeles through the discovery and communication with ghosts. And it is just never talk about death. It is in no way scary, but the kinds of things they unearth are the kinds of things that people, I think all curious people, the kind of questions they have about the cities they live in, which is what used to be here. So like in one episode, a woman is opening a Asian fusion restaurant in Boyle Heights, which is a neighborhood in East Los Angeles, and the restaurant is haunted by a ghost. And we learn about what used to be on the spot of this. Or it's an episode in a skate park in Venice, and you learn sort of about the history of skateboarding in Venice, and an episode about indigenous people who once lived in Los Angeles, and an episode about Koreatown.
Do they have an episode about the 405? And they're like, you know what used to be here? Traffic. It's still here.
Yeah, well, no, that's
often
that's
when on the 405, I'm like, maybe we're all ghosts. Maybe we're all dead. We're just sitting in this.
That is a very specific Los Angeles feeling that as of yet is not been voiced by these children. But
just a thought. I'm just throwing ideas up on the whiteboard.
There's no shame in that.
Yeah.
First of all. But I just think it's a really beautiful, gentle, interesting show. Like there aren't actors doing the voices. So people talk like people and talk like kids. And it's really a wonderful show if you have children like ages 4 and up. But, you know, this is the kind of thing, Chris, where you and, I don't know, Bryce, what's his name?
Yeah.
Your large adult, not quite son.
Yeah.
Like you guys could watch this and maybe get a little misty, but then like, you know, clear your throat and like go take a walk in the backyard so you don't actually have to deal with the emotions. But like, I it's a great show. I just wanted to throw a little light on it.
I like that. I like that's a good random recommendation. Should we start talking about fall TV, or did you have anything else from the chamber that you wanted to let out for people?
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. I came in with a laundry list. Quick two things. Listeners know, Chris and I, we love the Criterion Channel.
I even got a chance to make a Criterion commentary track for Visions of Eight, which is now streaming on the Criterion Channel. You can hear me and Sean and Amanda in our commentary on this that amazing documentary.
Which is about the Olympics, I believe,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
Which, that's awesome. And people streaming diets, their budgets are, you know, stretched, but it's such a great investment. But this particular month, I wanted to call attention to it before we ran out of August. There's a collection on there, and this is one of the great things about it. It's the movies cycle on and off the service, but they're often curated into collections. And there's a collection on there called Neo-Noir. And like every movie I've ever loved is in this collection, plus things I've never heard of that I'm already figuring out and starting to discover and loving. So movies like Robert Altman's Long Goodbye, Chinatown, Night Moves, one of the great Gene Hackman performances from the 70s, Body Heat, Body Double, Stephen Frears is the hit, Michael Mann's Manhunter is on there. Just all terrific movies. Blood Simple, Coen Brothers' first movie. Just great movies by masters. Just super vibey. But it's been also fun to discover movies on there that maybe didn't quite break through and maybe for probably good reasons. So I did spend some time this weekend not watching Free Guy and watching a movie called The Bedroom Window, which is directed by Curtis Hanson in 1987.
Oh, is this the Steve Guttenberg movie?
So you don't step on it. This is the thing. So Curtis Hanson, you know, one of the great he knew what he was doing filmmakers, like from the 80s on. He made L.A. Confidential. He made 8 Mile. He made In Her Shoes, which is a really good movie, actually. And he made The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, I believe, was his. But almost as a dry run for that period of success, he made this extremely indebted to Hitchcock movie called The Bedroom Window, which is a really cool premise about a couple having an affair who witness a crime. But in order to protect the woman from having to admit having the affair, the guy who lives in the apartment pretends to have been the witness, and hijinks ensue. And the woman is played by like the GOAT actress, Isabelle Huppert. Great character turns from people like Wallace Shawn and Carl Lumbly, and Elizabeth McGovern is in it. And all of it is working, except at some point the studio was just like, Curtis, we love your vision. Like we too are cinephiles and love Hitchcock, and you've got the great dame of French acting here. What do we need? What is this spicy pie need?
The Police Academy guy.
It needs the guy from Police Academy.
Well, I guess he was in Diner lead. Too. I mean, Gutenberg had a minute, like a little.
Yeah, he had three. He was one of the three men with the baby.
That's true.
There's nothing wrong with him. He's a bright, charismatic comic presence, but it's just a little jarring for Isabelle Huppert to be like, Terry, I love you. You are so compelling. I've never met a man like you. And you could just picture somewhere in the background the beatboxing guy from the Police Academy movies just laying down like a slap bass soundtrack. Right. But anyway, it was thrilling to watch. Those things are fun. I'll save the next recommendation for next week because we have fall TV to talk about.
Well, and, I mean, I think that what we're doing here is we're challenging everything we ever learned from journalism school. It's like they always say, put the most important stuff up top. But you and I are
Who said that?
Bob Woodward? I don't know.
First of all, we never went to journalism school. So joke's on you.
I did a semester at Temple. I did one semester of J school at Temple. So I got that going for me.
What did you learn there that you put into practice?
That I didn't want to be a court reporter. Or that I didn't have the discipline to do that. Andy, I wanted to talk to you about fall TV just because, so we obviously, that we got a month at least of when Succession is coming out. It's coming out in October. I don't have a guess or any inside information as to what day in October that's going to be. This happens in August. Every August, I feel like, is the same. Mm-hmm. You're like, how long could this month possibly go? There's no sports on. I feel unmoored. I feel like, you know, I have soccer on the weekends, but for the most part, you know, we've got Nine Perfect Strangers. The Chair just came out. We're coming off of White Lotus. It's not like we've been in some kind of desert. Ted Lasso is still on, although experiencing a little bit of an online backlash, I would note. But then you're going to wake up one day and it's going to be after Labor Day and then it all comes fast and furious at you. You know, like Netflix just announced that they have 42 movies hitting the surface between now and the end of the year. Uh-huh. And we got a couple of pretty big shows coming in the coming weeks. So I thought I would just kind of throw them at you. I wanted to call this a temperature check. But I don't know if, since we actually do have to do temperature checks at many places, I don't know if that's an appropriate term. So maybe just like, we're just doing an anticipation index here, right?
Yeah, because our last year and a half has ruined that. Because usually like a hot temperature means like I'm rushing in.
Right.
But at all dining establishments, a hot temperature means you cannot enter.
Exactly.
With good reason.
So let's start with Succession, which we still have, you know, we got that one trailer. Mm-hmm. I think that this is... I actually had forgotten it'll have been 2 years since season two was on. Isn't that unbelievable?
It's crazy, but I, you know,
outside of Curb Your Enthusiasm, can you think of many like shows that were in its prime that had this kind of delay?
Well, I mean, I think Better Call Saul is going to have an even longer delay, right?
Sure.
I mean, I think that this is the new normal, but to your point, I mean, The Sopranos. The Sopranos took a long break in the middle of its run because David Chase was like, I need to reset.
Okay.
Before it came back for, I think, season six. I think there may have been 2 years elapsed between them, but that was by choice and because of the clout he had.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know. But as we've said before, when talking about Succession, a weird convergence of events leads me to think that this has not harmed the show and, in fact, it has helped it.
I agree with you. It's been funny. I don't know. Obviously, we haven't really talked about Ted Lasso. You don't really watch Ted Lasso, but it has started to get like a little bit more of a wait, are we sure this season is good commentary? And I think the last couple of episodes in particular have drawn the ire of some people. Mm. And I don't think that Ted Lasso, for as sensationally popular as it was in its first season, is on the same level of Succession in terms of its... I don't know, at least critical acclaim, if not audience belovedness. But it did make me think for a second, like, is it possible that we could somehow find ourselves? Is it possible that we could ruin Succession for ourselves?
Oh, we can always ruin anything.
Like, could there be a backlash? Like, oh, it's just not as good or it's just not the same.
I think that is very unlikely. I think that if anything, the desire for more Succession just literally like a drug labeled Succession to inject into our eyeballs is so high that no matter what Jesse Armstrong and his team deliver, it will be highly, highly rated and swooned over for at least 2/3 of the season. If for some reason they didn't deliver, I think, yeah, the bottom will drop out in a pretty intense way on the old Twitter box. But the show is such a smartly constructed machine. You know, I just don't see it.
I honestly don't believe that at all. I was just trying to think of like something, what's the tension going into this new season of
the tension
Succession?
Is give me a new season.
Yeah, that's exactly. Just drop it on my fucking head. Like, I don't really care. Let's move on to some shows that we do have some questions about. And the first one that I wanted to talk about is Why the Last Man, which unbelievably is coming out in a month after all of these delays, after all of these false starts, after all of these showrunner changes and casting changes and everything else. we finally are going to get to see this show. Now, I do think that I'm curious about the collective appetite for dystopian and post-apocalyptic culture in a world that feels increasingly dystopian and post-apocalyptic.
Chris, I think we're still pre-apocalyptic.
Yeah, no, I know.
I take your point.
But you just see what I'm saying. Like,
it's coming.
There are shows, I think there are times when, you know, it those things can feel like allegories, and there are some times when you're just like, this is a little on the nose, my guy, you know, for right now. Mm-hmm. But I want my number one question about Why the Last Man is, do you think that it's finally being released pretty much puts the kibosh on my pitch for Why : The Last Mane, Mane, about a guy in the mid-2000s who's collecting all the Gucci Mane mixtapes?
Wow. I've been a supporter of this project of yours ever since you pitched it to me in the back booth at Hi-Fi in the East Village. And the fact that you're now just burning it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Landgraf just won't respond to me.
That's a damn shame.
Was this a big comic for you? Was this a big big title for you? Yeah.
I read this comic in monthlies when it came out. This is the great writer Brian K. Vaughan's book with the artist Pia Guerra. It is about a mysterious event that causes the death of all men in the world, save for one, who is the protagonist of the series. And I have to admit, you know, my appetite for a show with that log line at this moment is not super high. But so my interest is actually almost counterintuitive, and it's a lot more almost on the business end. Because a couple weeks ago, when we were talking about Reservation Dogs, a show which is still delightful, FX on Hulu, we were praising the FX development process and the space that they give their half-hour creators to kind of just vibe out, right? Like to trust them to make their vision, and that vision really resonates, whether it's Reservation Dogs or What We Do in the Shadows or Dave or Atlanta is the biggest example of that. This is a test. You know, I if we get to talk to Landgraf or Nick Grad or Eric Schreier, Gina Balian at FX, like I wonder if they would say this is one of the hardest climbs they've ever done.
Yeah.
In that slam dunk hot comic book property, they get it, and then it's in development heck for years. I mean, it was going to be a movie, then it's a TV show, then it's at FX. And as you said, it was set up with an entirely different creative team.
Did you say heck
team.
Because you don't want to offend any demons who are listening to our show?
At that moment, I remembered that I spent 10 minutes talking about Paw Patrol and City of Ghosts. And so I was like, I better walk back. I just better check my language. It went very far down the line, not long. It went further down than most shows.
With they almost shot entirely a pilot, different right? Creator.
They shot a pilot, a very expensive pilot that I don't know this to be true, but from what I understand or what I've heard, much of, if not all of that pilot was scrapped and
reshot. And Barry Keogh was York, star. Right? Yeah, right.
There is a moment in the development process when a lot of people, executives blink, right? This isn't worth it anymore. Like, and smart executives are often the ones who are like, I'm not going to throw good money after bad,
right?
And it's time to just move on. They believed in this project. They believed in the new showrunner. They believed in the creative process to the degree that we're getting the show, and whatever buzz one can get these days is good. It seems positive. I've heard positive things. So I'm pretty excited just to see what the show is with the knowledge that it briefly was many other things. I mean, I think that's just kind of fascinating. The kind of tortured development process that we're describing is usually the kind of, it's the type of thing that you usually hear about massive misfires in the movie theaters.
Right.
Right, where everyone wants to write the postmortem, the obituary about it, like in all the ways it went wrong from the beginning that someone should have seen. A lot of the steps that we're talking about with Why the Last Man tick those boxes, and yet, did they salvage it? That's fascinating. And I'm
excited
to see.
We'll find out in a month. Some other ones that are coming in the coming weeks that I'm really curious about. Obviously, The Morning Show had its new trailer today. Andy and I, you know, I made a couple of notes when I watched this, and I thought I was just coming out September 17th. I'm just going to read off
the trailer, not when you watch the first season.
I'm just going to read off what I wrote down when I was watching the trailer. Okay.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Crud up back. Sorry. Margulies back on her Alicia Florrick bullshit. Will Arnett on his Devin Banks bullshit. Carell locked up on a set somewhere in Burbank, just seething. quote, we're trying to get ahead of this coronavirus thing, close quote, and sweet birthday back, baby.
Wow.
So all those things they have going for it. They've got an expanded cast, inexplicably bringing Aniston back to the broadcast. They're going to get ahead of this coronavirus thing. So I imagine it's set, what, last spring, right? If they're trying to get ahead of coronavirus.
Yeah, and then I assume they got ahead of it.
That's right.
Just like we did. Great. Where's the drama, though?
Do you think that for a show that you missed largely the first season of, are you going to dive back into this? Are you going to dive into the second season for Billy alone? For just Billy?
This is a similar tone to when you asked me what I got up to on the weekend. Like, no, I think you know the answer.
I could see. Why don't we do this?
Yeah.
At the ocean, there are two kinds of swimmers. There's the person who's like, I need to just, you know, walk up to my shins and then start splashing my shoulders with water, right, to get used to the temperature and psychologically prepared for it. Then there's the guy who runs in from like back deep in the beach and just dives right into a wave. That's me.
And that's what you're teaching Bryce how to behave.
I'm just like, we're going to read William Finnegan's Barbarian Years and fucking fight waves, brother. No, I'm going to do that for Morning Show. Like, I've watched the first season. I'm going to dive right into the wave. I'm going to let you know how the water is, okay?
I love it.
Because we
got to
get Billy on the pod. Okay, so let's burn through a couple more of these. I haven't asked you about this yet.
Okay.
American Crime Story impeachment, which comes, yes, I think, on September 7th, if I remember my dates correctly. Here's my big takeaway from the abundance of trailers that they have released for this in the last 3 weeks. Really, like, quite a push. So I think I'm starting to get the feeling like this is going to be a American Crime Story OJ Simpson moment, where I think we're going to revisit a lot of the stuff from the Clinton impeachment, Monica, et cetera. But for, I have, sure, a question about all these trailers. We still haven't gotten a significant amount of time with Clive Owen as Bill Clinton, which leads me to believe they are either sitting on Marlon Brando in The Godfather level performance or a Marlon Brando in Dr. Moreau level performance. Like, it's going to be one or the other.
That is definitely a take, and you may be right. I choose to think about it slightly differently, which is they have two things. One, it's very, very hard. I mean, presidential performances, especially in this era, are almost uniformly imitations, right? And it's distracting to be like, oh, he's just like Bill Clinton,
yeah,
or whatever. Or Edie Falco plays Hillary Clinton. Like, I think it was a smart move to minimize them in the trailer, because immediately it becomes about, wow, Clive Owen's doing a great job being Bill Clinton.
Sure.
And it's distracting from the show they want to tell. I think the second piece of it is, from my understanding of it, the reason to tell this story about something that, you know, obviously isn't fresh in a lot of people's minds, but for people of our age or generation, it certainly is.
Is it for Sarah Paulson to win more awards?
Well, that's going to happen. But I think it's more to tell the story of the Monica Lewinsky and Linda Tripp and the people who were actually the prime movers of this, that shook the firmament that the much larger figures were resting on, in a way that, you know, the changes are the aperture, the way we're considering the story. I think that, like, the Slow Burn podcast has done something similar. Our buddy Sam Esmail is producing a show called Gaslit right now that is a Watergate show, but I think it's a similar thing where it's like, yes, you know the major players, but what you don't know is these little butterfly wings flapping, yeah, that caused the hurricane. So I think that's interesting. And I think in general, it just makes the show, to me, so it's working, I guess I want to say, because I'm interested in this because it does appear to be coming at it from a different angle.
Okay.
And the cast is bananas.
The cast is nuts. The cast is really good.
It's Beanie Feldstein as Monica Lewinsky, Sarah Paulson as Linda Tripp, Margot Martindale, Billy Eichner as Matt Drudge.
Yeah.
Kobe Smulders as Ann Coulter. You got our buddy Colin Hanks in it. Fred Melamed, Mira Sorvino, Kathleen Turner.
Yeah.
Blair Underwood. What is even happening? Can't wait.
Last one, Scenes from a Marriage. I wanted to take your temperature here. I had one idea of how we could have made this more relatable for you. Okay. I feel like you're like resisting this. Do you think it would have been better if this had been about Jessica Chastain's Zero Dark Thirty character getting together with Oscar Isaac's Born Legacy character and like their kind of post-war on terror relish falling apart? Or is that, either way? Like,
is
you're
that,
out.
Is that, Is that a sext? That's the hottest thing you've ever said.
Well, we can't that do it because, spoiler alert, I think Oscar Isaac's character dies in a drone strike in Bourne Legacy.
Does he? Does he, though?
That's true.
That could be, I mean, crazier things have happened.
People could have lived through that. Yeah, that's right.
I would love that. I mean, you're pretty fired up about this. Because the thing is that, Chris, what you love, and you've always been this way, you love actors. And yeah. You love a showcase for actors. You're never happier than when you are inside of a black box theater watching two young, hungry Juilliard graduates get after it. Right? Like, that is just, that's what moves you.
And I love this, craft. Yeah.
There is big, big MFA energy in the show for me. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does seem like an intense thing. And I'm not sure if that's where my head's at. I'm not sure.
You're just in this city of ghosts with the Paw Patrol.
We all have different, by the way, if we're being really honest, City of Ghosts and Paw Patrol could also be subtitled Scenes from a Marriage. Like, it is all connected. So I'm just saying, like, you know, open your mind here.
Well, we've talked about TV that's coming on Zoom. We're going to talk about a show that's already on. We'll get into The Chair right after this break.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
All right, Andy, we're back. Let's talk about The Chair, which was released on Friday, a whopping 3 hours of content from this season. And I guess I wanted to sort of start there before we got into the nuts and bolts of the show itself. It was co-created by Amanda Peet, who co-wrote the first three episodes. It stars Sandra Oh and Jay Duplass and Holland Taylor and Bob Balaban. It's a great ensemble cast. It's set in I think, New England liberal arts university that is going through upheaval both on campus and behind the scenes in the English department, where Sandra Oh's character has just been named chair, the titular chair of the English department. And it's a lot of it is about, you know, making older literature relevant to today's students. A lot of it is about some of the issues around freedom of speech and cancel culture, which, at least if you read the internet, is a constant, you know, pressure point on campuses these days. And it's also just a really well-observed family dramedy about Ji-Yoon, who's the character Sandra Oh plays, about her family. So what jumped out at me, and it's not dissimilar to something that I've been thinking about Reservation Dogs, which I just watched the most recent batch of episodes that came out, is how, for as revolutionary as some of the formatting can feel in terms of these 30-minute episodes, in terms of like a 6-episode season, or in the case of The Chair, sometimes it's really interesting to look at all that and get kind of distracted by the time spent or your investment that's required for the show, but then still see the bones of old TV there, you know, mm-hmm. like still see the very solid ABC plotting and you know, the ways in which they spin off storylines, then sort of draw them all back together towards the end of the season, but almost make it episodic. And it's, you could enjoy an episode of The Chair in a vacuum and probably understand what's going on more or less. I mean, they do a very good job. It almost feels like something that could have been made for a slightly progressive network, you know, and a different era of American television. So I don't really know if I have a question coming out of that, but for as much as I like The Chair, I almost saw, speaking of City of Ghosts, like the other television shows it could have been right. While I was watching it.
I understand that. And I think that you're exactly right to highlight the structure and the form, because I really enjoy the show. I've watched 4 out of 6. Looking forward to finishing it. Very pleasurable.
I've watched the same, yeah.
Very, very pleasurable series. Funny, has a very smart, but I think appropriately delicate touch in dealing with quote unquote hot button issues. It is mm-hmm. very much about this moment, but to your point, smartly, I don't know if it prioritizes, but it smartly emphasizes the family comedy. There's a lot of slapstick in it. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of nice feelings related to characters who care about each other that all come from a TV 101 playbook. I also think that it's canny awareness of the show that it's making, what other shows that it's pulling from. I think all of that works in a forward-thinking way as well, which is to say there is a version of this. Absolutely. This could have been 15, 20 episodes first mm-hmm. season with as an ongoing show. Why not? A few years ago. It is being billed as, and we haven't finished the season, but it's being billed as a miniseries.
Yeah.
As if this is a one and done. And I think Sandra Oh found time to film it during her hiatus from Killing Eve, which is still her primary commitment in terms of series television. That's to the series' advantage, because not just because of the escalating crises that Sandra Oh's character has to face feel, you know, stakesy, as much as a show set at a university could feel stakesy. It's that it does certain things with its characters that fast forward them to the most interesting place without any fat. Specifically, and again, I think the show really hinges on not just the observational writing and the clever tone, and we should credit the co-creator, Annie Julia Wyman, who created the show with Amanda Peet, who comes from an academic background and probably brought some of her observations along the way. But the show really rests on Sandra Oh and Jay Duplass mm-hmm. are just giving wonderful performances. And one day, we've had Mark on podcast a bunch. I think Jay was only on once. But like, this guy was like, I'm not an actor until he turned 40. And now he's just a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
Who has that switch? But they have great chemistry and the show really, really rests on them.
Did I ever tell you about the time
I went... All that was built up just to say, sorry, Chris, that the romantic sparks and everything that's resting on these two characters in a long-running show or a show with an eye for a long run would be so parceled out. You know, it would be crumb after crumb.
Yeah. You would start with, like, Sandra Oh's character waiting, like, she would not have the job yet. Then maybe two or three episodes in, she would get it. Then two or three later episodes, you would have the bill sort of fall from grace. I mean, everything
but I
that is
purely the romantic storyline. Like at the end of the first episode, he's like, let's be together. You know, like it's like, let's go. And that gives a charge to a show that I think it's an old fashioned charge. It's Sam and Diane on Cheers. But putting that into the context of a, you know, something sort of genteel, a university tenure battles and comedy. I mean, it just gives it a charge that makes it feel a lot more compelling than it might otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the entire show is more so than almost than a lot of other series that I've seen recently is made or broken by those two leads. Like, if you have someone who's a little bit more aggro or, dare I say, traditionally masculine than Jay Duplass, like, I think some of the behavior in terms of the drinking and the gaffes that he has and some of the inappropriate situations he finds himself in come off like a little bit different. You know, they come off a little like maybe this guy does deserve to get farmed out a little bit. And then and then the same thing goes for Oh, who's able to switch from incredibly touching dramatic moments to incredibly broad comic moments, and you don't even notice her touch the stick shift. You know what I mean? Like, you're just like, oh, now I'm on the verge of tears. Just a second ago, I was laughing my ass off as her and Holland Taylor were stuck in like a basement office somewhere. So that kind of ability to transition between tone is, you know, you really have to be, you're in the 99th percentile when you can do that as a performer.
It's really true. They brilliantly cast two leads who are not comedic actors or dramatic actors. They're just performers. They're just actors. You know, there's no, all actors say that they approach the material the same, whether it's, you know, billed as a comedy or not. But I think that not all actors are capable of playing both sides of the human condition with the same level of emotional presence and truth. And like watching Sandra Oh do this, it's weird. I mean, she's always been incredible. Mm-hmm. And we loved the first season and a half of Killing Eve. But something about watching her in this has just made me really appreciate her talent. I'm not sure what it is about the show. Maybe it's the fact that it's a small marvel to me that the show works so well.
There's
so many things that it could have tripped on, and I find it really light on its feet.
The pleasures of this show in some ways are kind of obvious. Like, you'd be like, oh yeah, this is a cool portrait of two adults in crisis, sort of finding a little bit of solace with one another, and also while the world falls out down around them. Like, that shouldn't be an out there concept for a TV show, but it increasingly is, because usually, like, you need some sort of, you know, motivating mystery or something to unpack from it. And then furthermore, like, I just find that the setting to be awesome. I mean, I love campus comedy novels. I think I wish there were more shows or movies set in schools. I generally really enjoy them. I think they're a really good canvas to paint, like, behavior and to see people in, like, these particularly vulnerable positions. Often people are living pretty close together. You see, there's a lot of, like, pretty unforced interaction that I really like and I personally miss from my own college days. But yeah,
at the J school?
Yeah, at J school, when I'm just like there. At first, I spent the whole day down at the courts, and then I go to the bar and I'm cracking peanuts and throwing them on the ground. And, you know, guys are like, would you get any scoops today?
College stuff. I agree with that. And I think that the other thing that made me happy about the show, just that it existing, Netflix doesn't feel like a natural home for it. But happy that they took the chance. In my experience on the other side of the ball, like, there are certain areas, professions or industries that people are just allergic to on the development side. One is the art world. You know, if you like Velvet Buzzsaw, cover your ears. But, like, anything about art or artists, people run screaming from.
How come?
And I think it's I think partially it's because it's difficult to satirize an industry or a field that is so rife with self-satire and is so preposterous at times. I think the bigger one is this feeling of, oh, no one's going to understand that. You know, the middle America that we're imagining, even if it's a made up middle America, doesn't care about gallery politics or, you know, representational mixed media, whatever. I'm just throwing word salads out, but, like, they don't care about that. So we're not going to steer towards it. And I think academia is a similar thing. Oh, that's too elitist. That's too highbrow. You're mentioning Hannah Arendt in the third episode. What are we doing? But I think the show is a nice corrective to that really, I think, kind of lazy knee-jerk thinking that if you imbue any world with characters with, you know, that have humor or heart or stakes, you can jump into any universe and find something compelling. And I'm glad, look, it's underexplored because of it. I mean, I don't remember a sort of erudite college comedy since Wonder Boys, which was mostly about Michael Douglas getting stoned, right? I mean, I don't know what the Dear White People is said at a college, so we got that. But I'm not saying that there should be a lot more 1% of the 1% shows with, you know, with tenure and syllabus jokes.
But that's that's cool thing about this show is that, like, it's kind of shabby. You know what I mean? Like,
yes,
the teachers are aging. The stuff that they're teaching is under... Is kind of like underappreciated at this point. Like, it's not like they're, like, dining out and just being like, we're setting the tone for the intellectual discourse of the country. Yes. They're like, nobody gives a shit what we have to say anymore.
That's such a great point. And there's something about it that feels kind of as lived in as the corduroy jackets that David Morse is rocking as the dean, where, like, a lot of the show is about, yes, Sandra Oh gets the job that she's coveted, but is basically, as she describes in the later episode, they pulled the pin and handed me the grenade. Like, this is the end of an English department and I have to clean up the mess of the older professors. And then it shows, like, what these tenured lions and lionesses in their fields who have spent, you know, multiple decades shaping young minds at the most elite, one of the more elite institutions, and they're getting paid, like, you know, it shows, like, $87,000 a year, which is great money. But also, in the scheme of a TV universe where it's either, like, Succession or The Conners, like, I kind of liked the, like, I'm not saying this is blue collar. I just threw out a very large annual salary. But I there's something about the way that it doesn't look up to these people. They're just people.
Yeah,
that I appreciate.
I mean, my mom was a teacher. I think, like, I kind of remember this. Yeah, this feels like too. A little bit more more familiar to me, that, like, rather than, like, some rock star professor who has a Jaguar and is, like, you know, basically Malcolm Gladwell. And I think that these people are all, like, operating in the world where they're just like, I don't have that way to get out. Like, the only thing I have is tenure. Like, the only thing I have is job security.
Did you just back your way into a subtweet criticism of Mark Wahlberg and The Gambler?
He had another revenue stream. That guy.
Great point.
Let me ask you this. Did seeing the show shot in Pittsburgh, I believe. I'm not sure if it was shot at Carnegie Mellon or whatever, but it takes place at a fictional university called Pembroke, which I think, to me at least, seems Dartmouth-y.
Well, also, not to, I mean, Pembroke is the name of the college that was the women's college that Brown's sister school.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That was weird because like half the campus is called Pembroke. So I thought that was weird that they took an actual no longer functioning university name, but one that still is like half of the Brown campus is the Pembroke campus.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah. So, but I was wondering if this made you long for Northeastern college winters, because I know your boy, you do not like getting chilly, but I was like, no. all of the running around with boots and coats in the snow, that I was like, Greenwald, hate this.
Oh my God. I hated it so much just to get to the dining hall to like have cereal. What are we doing? But that was the only thing that I bumped on, not just because I personally detest winter and I'm thrilled with my decision to move to California. It's that the show purports to be giving us the beginning of the school year, the fall semester, and it's already
like tons of snow on the ground. Yeah.
Deep powder.
Yeah.
Deep powder, which is it's not the direction I think climate change is taking our Septembers. But I do think that probably had to do more with the COVID scheduling of when they shot the show.
I don't want to be a dick, but can I say something else that I bumped my head on with the show?
Okay, yeah.
What's up with the songs?
Like, okay.
There's nothing wrong with the music supervision. In fact, I love a lot of the music in the show. Like, they play Phoenix, and they play the Smiths, and they play La Tigra. But, like, from what POV are these songs being, like, delivered?
Hmm.
Now, I don't mean to be like persnickety about it, but like, is this supposed to be like the music that Ji-Yoon likes or that Bill likes? Or is this just songs that Amanda Peet likes? Because they don't really have any obvious relationship. Like when they're chasing Juju, the daughter, around and La Tigra is playing, like, I don't think Decepticon is related to the action we're seeing.
It does put the chair in the same musical cinematic universe as The Pursuit of Love and Briar Patch, who just have, all of us have kept Kathleen Hanna's pockets fat over the last 2 years.
But what do you think of song. That?
I think the needle drop that plays with the opening title card is Vampire Weekend, and that's perfect. I mean, right. that song is a, you know, that whole vibe is just Columbia Core, right? It's Ivy League, the sound of the Ivy League. That's the whole point of it. I think to your other question, it's a great question, one that isn't asked enough with music supervision. I do feel like it's just songs Amanda Peet likes.
Sure.
And it is, if they weren't also songs that I like, I would probably bump
I'm not, I wasn't trying to be like, get this Morgan Wallen off my show. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that there's anything objectionable about the songs that are chosen. But sometimes I'm just, I felt, not to fluff you up, I thought that the Briar Patch music was always very intentional. You know what I mean? Like, either it did something for the pace, it did something with the emotional colors of the show, it did something to direct kind of like the view, the audience attention to something. But this, I'm just kind of like, okay, like, you guys just, I mean, and I'm also just like, how much did it cost to get that Smith song?
Obviously, choosing the songs was one of the best parts of making a TV show and one of the things I was most excited about and had the most fun doing and the most proud of. But I'll say, and I don't know if we talked about this during that period, but one of the biggest arguments that Sam Esmail and I ever had was a needle drop that I was considering for the second episode, which was a popular indie rock song or a beloved indie rock song.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the song and I wanted to use it. And I loved the way the rhythm matched what Rosario was doing in the scene. And Sam was adamant that we not use that song. And he was very supportive, very rarely put his foot down about anything. But his point was, the song is too well known and it will take people out of the world.
Okay.
And I was wrong, but I fought him really hard on it. Ultimately, I found something, I feel like a Dick Dale instrumental or something, that worked so much better. And it taught me a really important lesson that I was not open to hearing at the time, which was, you have to love the song for the scene. And it has to service the scene and surprise people. It doesn't help anyone if it's calling attention to itself. You know what I mean?
I'm surprised you didn't use any songs from Gucci Mane's Mr. Zone 6.
I was saving all of that for you. I mean, What was that thing like after the Trump press conference where the guy was like, I worked on this story for months and he just tweeted it out. Like,
yeah.
As far as I you know, the, like the wheels I've been greasing for you to like have more meetings to shop this Gucci project around town. And Gucci. Now you're just giving it away.
I know. Gucci America.
Wait, Kaya, I'm sorry, we have to be honest about this and tell people that when we talked about the House of Gucci trailer, Chris also tried to spoil his Gucci Mane show and we convinced him to edit it out. And now, all right.
Do you remember when Gucci Mane just had a mixtape called Buy My Album?
Genius.
We didn't know what we had. Well, that brings us to the end of another Watch podcast.
what a journey.
Produced, as always, by Kaya McMullen, and we will be back on Thursday. It was great talking to you, Andy.
Special guest on Thursday.
Yeah?
That I spoke to.
Okay.
So it'll be new to you.
I was like, really?
Yeah, no, I did it. I booked it.
Gucci? Is he coming?
He and I are doing an intervention. You did not actually get the life
rights. You're doing the Young Jeezy pod. I'm doing the Gucci pod. And then we're going to have a versus.
So icy.
Great seeing you, man. I will talk to you on Thursday.